good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology in a complicated world that's interesting, fun, and understandable. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake, our first guest this morning, Rachel Ignatovsky. She's the author of Women in Science, 50 Fearless Pioneers Who Changed the World. This book celebrates the achievements of the intrepid women who have paved the way for the next generation of female engineers, biologists, mathematicians, doctors, astronauts, physicists, and more.
Good morning. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guest this morning is David Van Essen from Van Essen Laboratories and the Human Connectome Project. Mapping the human brain is one of the great scientific challenges of the 21st century. The Human Connectome Project is tackling a key aspect of this challenge by elucidating the neural pathways that underlie brain function and behavior. Deciphering this amazingly complex wiring diagram will reveal much about what makes us uniquely human and what makes every person different from all others.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Sage Creek Equestrian is a proud supporter of KPCW. We are a full-service year-round facility with three arenas, 14 by 12 stalls, private tack rooms, 24-hour on-site staff, along with tailor-to-fit boarding choices. We are on Facebook and at sagecreekequestrian.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, proud KPCW sponsor of Cool Science Radio. Have you been told you need a total knee or shoulder joint replacement? Information about alternatives is available on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning is Rachel Ignatovsky, who's the author of Women in Science, 50 Fearless Pioneers Who Changed the World. You know, for the last 3 years or so, our central theme and one of our main points of focus on Cool Science Radio has been the importance of STEM, the acronym Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics. STEM for kids. Our boys, our girls. And this book beautifully illustrates the educational women in science, highlights contributions of 50 notable women in the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics from the ancient to the modern world. Rachel Ignatovsky, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're really happy to have you because this has been a focus of this program. And let's just talk about what this book looks like. First of all, you're an illustrator, and the book is beautifully illustrated. And it's 50 vignettes, so there's like one page on each of these pioneering women in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. It's just beautifully put together.
Well, thank you so much. I truly believe that when something is beautiful, when you take the time to take dense information and make it whimsical and playful, and more importantly, make it fun, that's when learning becomes fun too. And you get to connect the viewer with this information for a lifetime because they're having a unique experience. So I really wanted to celebrate these women. This book is a celebration. And I did these illustrations. They're kind of on this darker background, this kind of charcoal dark background. And all of the women are brightly colored, and they're almost floating among their discoveries. So, like Rachel Carson is floating and exploring, and around her is fish and birds and wildlife, and she has her binoculars on, and you just feel this excitement for exploration and discovery. Lisa Meitner, she's kind of around her beakers and these exploding atoms, and she's discovering fission. And I also weave in facts about the women into the illustration that create even more movement within the image. So there's a lot going on. And I wanted to make it so that at a glance, you could understand everything you want to know about this woman. So at a glance, you can say, Lisa Meitner, she discovered fission. She's a scientist. You can kind of tell what era she's from. And then that kind of draws you in to want to learn more. So I really use illustration as a tool to make the information easy and accessible also.
And it wasn't just their accomplishments, but what they had to endure. And fortunately, it's a brave new world, so we're making some progress. But truth be told, as you describe in these vignettes, there were also challenges. Some of the women could not publish their work, or if they could, they had to take their name off, and some guy got credit for it. Many were excluded from meetings, from being part of the team. They were working behind the scenes, and they really weren't recognized for what they were doing. And one of the women here was told that if she was to marry, she would be fired. So tell us about that. Was that Barbara McClintock?
Or? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Barbara McClintock. Barbara McClintock was already a force in genetics. She already did some groundbreaking work when she was at Cornell doing her research. And then she got a job at the University of Missouri. And, at the University of Missouri, she didn't really fit in. She, would break some of their smaller rules. Like, she would have her students stay up late and continue working past their curfew. She would, I think there's actually a really cute story where one time she snuck into a window and all the neighbors kind of gasped. So she was working very hard. She was breaking some of their smaller rules, and she was just excelling at what she did. But one day she got called into her boss's office, and he read a newspaper article with a different Barbara McClintock who was getting married. And he said to her that if you ever got married, you would be fired. And in fact, if her lab partner and superior, if he left, they couldn't guarantee her position anymore. So, what I love about Barbara McClintock is that she was just like, enough's enough. She took a leave of absence without pay. She refused to, compromise in that way. And she left to get her own dream job, which would end up being just researching all day in a lab in New York. Planting fields and fields of corn and really getting down to the science of how all this stuff in the universe works. She went on to discover jumping genes, which are also known as transposons. And that was a huge discovery. So just think about that. Like, all that nitpicking, all that sexism, all those limitations that were one place of work set. What a loss of a brilliant mind who then brought so much to the field of genetics.
And she won the Nobel Prize.
She did, 30 years after her initial discovery of transposons. And for those who don't know, jumping genes mean that your genes kind of move around the genome. They turn on and off. It kind of explains the diversity of the world around us. It also explains how animals and plants evolve to their environment. So, before her, scientists really thought that genes and genetics were really rigid. And this flexibility and fluidity really changed the way that we think of genetics entirely. So, the Nobel Prize 30 years after that discovery, it's fantastic.
Speaking of Nobel Prizes, Rachel, Madame Curie, winner of two Nobel Prizes and in two different disciplines, which is highly unusual. And she's sort of if you look through this list of 50 women that pioneered in STEM, that she's probably the name that is the biggest household name, if we could say that. And you also mentioned Rachel Carson. That's another one. And maybe Ada Lovelace as well, to a lesser degree, as a household name. And so I'm wondering, take us to Madame Curie, and why is she a household name? Why did her name stick? Why did she garner all the respect and the honor and the praise while so many of these other women we've never heard of?
Well, she's the one that we learn about. Like, she's the one that we're taught about in history class and science class. And when when your teacher is like, let's talk about historic scientists, you hear Einstein, you hear Tesla, you hear Stephen Hawking, And then you'll also hear Marie Curie, and everyone can say, hey, I included a girl. You know, she became really, you know, yeah. And she became famous, you know, while she was alive because, you know, the prestige of being the first woman to win a Nobel Prize and then going and doing it again. And then there's that tokenism that comes in play when we teach history. And I really believe that, although, like, I think Marie Curie, she's the bomb.com. I mean, she's amazing. Like, you hear her life, the sacrifices that she made, the danger of her experiment, her work then in, World War I. You hear about all that, and you understand why she's recognized. But when you have only one or two women that we talk about, when we talk about historic women in scientists, it makes it normal to then see only one or two women in the room when you're in the scientific community. I think by sharing multiple stories, by having a diversity of narrative, when a little girl closes her eyes and thinks about who a scientist can be, if she has those role models, all of a sudden she can imagine herself before she could not. And that's really what I want this book to do. I want this book to introduce young girls to a number of role models. And I hope by sharing very different stories, by showing that women have been doing this work since really ancient Rome all the way up to now, that young girls and boys can change in their mind what they think of when they think of a scientist.
Right. You know, it's funny, Rachel. I would say that every parent of a young girl needs to purchase your book. But then I say to myself, well, wait a minute, why just young girls? I mean, young boys, old boys, old girls, we all need this book because, A, it's so fun to read and so illuminating. And the way you include the facts in it, like just speaking of the Curies, Madame and Mister, how they subjected themselves to radioactivity. And they coined the term, or she coined the term radioactivity, but they didn't really know what it was. So they would test themselves. And we all know now that, of course, that probably led to horrible health side effects. But little tidbits like that, that you include, really stick with a person, young, old, girl, boy, male, female, any of that.
Well, my favorite book growing up was, well, one of them was Amelia's Notebook. And if anyone read Amelia's Notebook, do you guys remember all the illustrations that were just in the margins and while you were hearing her story? And I even thought that book was great as an adult. I was like, this is a great book. And I wanted to create a science book like that that had, like, little cartoons of facts that I wanted people to want to read this book over and over again, because as they were reading, they would discover new things. So I wanted that playfulness in this book too. And a lot of times when we're talking about these dense subjects like astrophysics and you know, nerve growth hormone, you know, a lot of times it's really dense. That information can feel scary approaching it, especially especially if you didn't, like, go into science in college, if you are, you know, in middle school. So, like, I think there's adults and kids who are scared to approach that kind of information. And so I wanted to make it really playful, really easy, really fun. And I hope for adults and kids who read this book, that information becomes something that they never fear approaching, because they had so much fun learning about it for the first time, that they'll dive into more denser and even more complicated ideas. So that's another thing that I really hope for this book.
If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation with Rachel Ignatovsky, who's the author of Women in Science, 50 Fearless Pioneers Who Changed the World. I enjoyed reading about all of these people, but one of my favorites was Katherine Johnson. Like every other kid, I wanted to be an astronaut, and I followed NASA's Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo program. She was African-American, woman, 1918 she was born. And fortunately for us all, in the 50s, NASA began to hire women in engineering. And she applied and she got a job, and she had a lot to do with putting together the trajectories for the Mercury program and, most importantly, for the Apollo program in 1969 for the big moon landing, bringing that ship back to Earth, which is, you know, it's a lot of calculations. And when you're doing it by hand versus a computer, I can only imagine the amount of calculations. Can you talk about her?
Oh, yeah. She's actually one of my favorites, too. So you have to remember that when she started working at NASA, there was this idea of men's work and women's work. And the women, they were kind of seen like secretaries. They worked as computers. And like you said, you're doing math by hand. But computers, they actually take a complicated math problem and they cut it all up for different people to solve little different parts of the equation. And then they give the solution to the engineers and to the mathematicians, who were the men. And, I mean, that kind of culture within NASA at the time was so commonplace. It was commonplace in a lot of industries. But it was so commonplace that women actually were not allowed in the meeting where they talked about what they were working on, what the larger project was. Wow. Katherine Johnson wanted to be a part of those meetings. She wanted to know what she was working on. So she went to her boss and she said, "Is it against the law for me to be in one of these meetings?" And he was like, well, I guess it's not. And so she got to go to the meeting. She started asking questions. And that's how she actually became the lead in calculating trajectory. She became, you know, one of the first female mathematicians at NASA. And what's amazing is that, and here's just a little behind-the-scenes thing with this book. I'm getting this book ready to go to the printers. It's like maybe like a week or two away from going, you know, all the final files are being sent off. And my editor is like, "You need to check the news." At the age of 97, Katherine Johnson got awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom for her lifetime of work at NASA by Barack Obama. So you have to think, isn't that amazing? So I drew it in real quick, and we got it in the book.
That's
one of the
great.
Fun facts.
That is great. That is great. And
it's amazing. She went from not being allowed in the meetings to getting the highest civilian honor possible in this country.
Yeah.
So wonderful. Aren't you glad you didn't beat your deadline?
Oh, yeah. Never beat your deadline, kids. That's the real takeaway.
So also in your book, you have some statistics on women in STEM. I think it's from the 1970s. Can you give us an update and sort of tell us what's been going on the last 46 years and where are we going?
All right. So the statistics in this book, they were all taken from the 2013 census about women in STEM. And, you know, in the 1970s, representation was really, really low. In computer science, it was only about 15%. In math, it was 15%. And that was kind of the common for, you know, that 15 to 17%. And since then, it's gotten better, but it's still not enough. The gender gap within STEM work is, when you look at the workforce, only 24% of the workforce is women. There's a lack of opportunity. There's a culture that creates less opportunity, and we need to fight that culture. And there's many ways to do that. We can, we have to have scholarships for kids, for females going into STEM. We need to have, you know, directed diversity hires and directed diversity grant distribution for researchers. But we also have to change that culture in the hearts and minds. And I think one of the ways we could do that is through creating accessible materials by sharing these women's stories. And I hope this book is just a part of that movement to introduce more women into these fields and to make it a better culture. And I keep saying culture over and over again because it is culture, and you can change culture with great female role models. There's still a lot of work to be done. I'm just going to pull out one stat that's really bad, and that's engineering. In the 1970s, women were only 3% represented in engineering. And, yeah, it's gotten better, but as of 2011, only 13% of engineering was made up by women. That's where most of these statistics started in other fields. So, women make up 50% of the workforce, 50% of our population. Girls do just as well as boys, sometimes better, in these STEM subjects in school. We need that brain power. We need these girls to feel like they can be part of the solution.
13% in 2011, women in engineering. That's a staggering statistic. And what it says to me is there are all kinds of opportunities out there right now for women. And having just gone through the college application process with my son, some of his female friends who applied to engineering schools, they had a really good time, a good acceptance rate, shall we say, because of, you know, encouraging women. And what a wonderful thing that they can go to these engineering schools and represent.
I think this generation of girls, they are ready to kick some butt. It's changing. The culture is changing. Everybody wants this. It's just about making it happen now. So that's what's really exciting. But, I mean, even when we look at 2011 versus now, more women made up engineering and science graduates than they did the workforce. So there's still that gap between women who are graduating with degrees and then the opportunities that they're getting after college.
Right.
So we have to change the leadership. We have to change the culture.
That's right. So I wanted to ask you, Rachel, in this book, and I always wonder when someone writes a story on, you know, the 50 greatest, whatever it is, how do they choose, you know, the 50 greatest? And one woman in particular made me, it's such a great story. It's Maria Sibylla Marian, I think you might say her name, born in Germany in the mid-1600s. She was an illustrator like you and an entomologist. And until she drew the metamorphosis from caterpillar to butterfly, people didn't understand the connection. I just love that you included her.
Well, you know, especially in, you know, the mid-1600s, artists and scientists weren't that far apart. It was all about observation and taking the time to observe, take the notes, make connections. And observation is a huge part of science. So before her, people really thought bugs were magic. They thought that you could even do spells to create bugs. Like, oh, like we'll take this rotten apple and we'll like put some frankincense and myrrh on it and light it on fire, and then bugs will happen later. No one really understood it. She took the time to watch a caterpillar cocoon itself and become a butterfly, and she painted them in exquisite detail. Everyone should go online and look up Maria Sibylla Marian right now, because you will be, you know, your breath will be taken away with how gorgeous these scientific illustrations are. And she not only documented many different stages of a bug's life, she discovered new bugs, never before seen insects, by, going into the rainforest and, you know, picking up poisonous bugs and putting them into, you know, bottles and drawing them. Another thing that she did that nobody else did at the time was that she kept these insects alive while she was, you know, observing them. So she actually got to talk about their feeding habits, their life cycles. A lot of people, when they found an insect, they just pinned it and started drawing. So that's also the gap. She changed the practices in what it was to be an entomologist. So she really just made huge strides in that entire field and really impacted it through illustration, which I just think is so cool because I love illustration too.
So for our listeners, Maria, M-A-R-I-A, and maybe skip the middle name, Marian, M-E-R-I-A-N, and Google that and see if you can get to her, born in 1647, an illustrator. And I've told this story on Cool Science Radio before, but I was always fascinated by it. One of my professors at school, an astrophysicist, who really just a giant of an astrophysicist, anytime that he was in a meeting with other people, and maybe there might be biochemists in there and other astrophysicists, you know, a collaboration of these different disciplines, they always included an artist to sit there and sketch out as people were knocking ideas around and things like that. And I always thought that was just, I mean, that always intrigued me. And what I found out from him was that it was just very valuable to have an artist or an illustrator in there participating in the meeting and adding tremendous value. I don't know if you've heard of that before or if you ever get involved in anything like that, do you?
No, this is actually the first time I heard of someone getting hired to be in the classroom with them to draw. But I think that's amazing because some ideas are harder to put in words than they are to see in your mind.
Mm.
You know, for me, illustration has always been a tool that I've personally used to be able to learn. You know, I always drew things out to understand them. And actually, going way back, when I was a little kid learning how to read, I actually struggled a whole lot. I was tested for dyslexia. I had exotropia, which is a fancy way of saying I had a little lazy eye, so I got migraines when I read. And it wasn't until I started drawing, reading comics, watching cartoons, that I felt connected with the information and a whole new world of learning opened up for me. So I think for kids and adults, be open to learning and absorbing information in the way that works for you and your brain the best. I think, you know, a lot of people feel apprehensive or like a little shameful that they want to draw instead of write. And I think everyone should just embrace who they are and learn the way that they want to learn.
I'm reminded of a show that Lynn and I did a couple years ago. We had a group of girls in here that were in a robotics competition. They were with a group called Park City Cats, PC Cats, and they won the competition. And this one young lady had not been introduced to engineering prior to this experience. And as a result of this experience, she found out that engineering was not only fascinating, but it was cool. And and she got back to us maybe 6 months later. We found out that she was accepted at my alma mater, University of Maryland, in the engineering program. And that was, you know, you never know how you're going to grab somebody if it's from reading your book or participating in a robotics competition. You just don't know what it's going to be. But there are a lot more people turned on to STEM today, that's for sure.
I think it's wonderful. I mean, these are the problem solvers of our future. Like, and I also think, like, you can't become what you don't see. So by introducing people to get their hands dirty, sharing stories with them, all of a sudden these new career paths open up to you. I know there was a time in American history where most women were like, well, I'm either going to be a school teacher or a nurse, and then I'm going to get married because that's all they saw. And then it just takes a role model, a story, or an experience. And a whole new path opens up to you.
We want to thank you very much for joining us on the program this morning. We very much enjoyed your book. Rachel Ignatovsky, she has written Women in Science, 50 Fearless Pioneers Who Changed the World. Thanks for joining us, Rachel.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been so wonderful.
Thanks, Rachel.
Okay. We shall return after these messages.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
The Spur and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur is open Thursday through Sunday nights with dinner, drinks, and live music. Information available at thespurbarandgrill.com for menu and music schedules.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. Join me each week here on KPCW for The Splendid Table. We give you a fresh take on the subject of food with great attitude and originality. We look at the way food plays out in your life. It opens you up to the world around you and the Park City community. That's The Splendid Table, Sunday mornings at 9, right here on KPCW.
Brought to you by the River Horse on Main.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Rachel Ignatovsky, the author of Women in Science, 50 Fearless Pioneers Who Changed the World. What a fantastic book. Our next guest is David Van Essen from Van Essen Laboratories and the Human Connectome Project. This project, led by Washington University, University of Minnesota, and Oxford University, is comprehensively mapping human brain circuitry in a target number of 1,200 healthy adults using cutting-edge methods of non-invasive neuroimaging. It will yield invaluable information about brain connectivity, its relationship to behavior, and the contributions of genetic and environmental factors to individual differences in brain circuitry and behavior. David Van Essen, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Good morning, and thank you very much for this opportunity to chat with you.
Well, it's exciting stuff. There's so much we don't know about the brain, and probably as a scientist, you know that there's a lot that we think we know about the brain, but that we really don't. But we're now, thanks to really science and technology, learning more. And let's start off with talking about MRI, magnetic resonance imagery, the difference between functional and structural.
Sure. Many people have seen images of their own brain or of relatives or colleagues' brain in what we call a structural image of the brain, which shows where the gray matter is, where the white matter is, and what's unique about the structure of each individual brain. The dominant structure of the human brain is the cerebral cortex, which is a sheet of tissue. It's kind of, think of a big 13-inch pizza that got crumpled up to fit it inside the skull. When we look at the living human brain using structural MRI, we can see all of those folds and see how the folding pattern is distinct. It's essentially a brain print analogous to a fingerprint of each individual. We can also look at what parts of the brain are active under various conditioning, and that's what functional MRI provides. It's a way of having the same subjects in the same scanner but in a different scanning session where they're lying quietly in the scanner, but doing a task such as remembering images that they've seen a few seconds before and comparing them to what's currently on the screen. That's called a working memory task, and it's one of many different tasks that were carried out in the Human Connectome Project to give a representation, images or pictures of what parts of the brain turn on and what parts turn off during one or another task. So that's the basic distinction between functional MRI and structural MRI.
Okay. So maybe you could also help us to understand sort of where we were with brain imaging and how it relates to where we are now. And I'm thinking of, you know, what we think we knew about the brain and, you know, we knew about the prefrontal cortex and how it relates to decision making and maybe like the amygdala relates to feeling fear and the hippocampus to memory, these sorts of things. And how does that relate to what we're learning now with the Human Connectome Project?
Great question. I like to start with an analogy, thinking about the surface of the Earth and maps that we make of the surface. When we look at the world around us, we see hills and mountains and valleys and rivers and various features that we call geographical parts of the landscape. And those are analogous to the folding pattern of the human cerebral cortex, what we call the geography of the human brain. When we can return to the Earth part of the analogy, we also know that there are political landscapes and that the Earth's surface of the land contains approximately 200 different political subdivisions that we call countries and finer-grained subdivisions of those. So to understand where the countries are located, we need to understand not just what the physical landscape is like, but what the interactions and communications and organization is of the billions of people that populate the Earth's surface. Returning to the cerebral cortex for the human brain, the billions of neurons within each individual's human cerebral cortex are organized and communicate and are connected with one another that reveal what we call cortical areas, maps of the arrangement of different functional subdivisions of the cerebral cortex that are very analogous to the political subdivisions, the countries of the Earth's surface.
Hmm.
With that in mind, investigators of the Earth's surface, the cartographers over centuries, went from very crude and picturesque but often wildly inaccurate maps of the Earth's surface. But over the centuries, and particularly in the past century, we've gotten vastly improved maps of what the landscape, physical and political subdivisions of the Earth's surface. Returning to the analogy of the human brain and cerebral cortex, about a century ago, we had very quaint and charming maps of what the anatomists of a century ago thought were the major subdivisions of the human cerebral cortex. And those were, and in fact still are, widely used today, even though in recent decades, magnetic resonance imaging has given us vastly more information that allows us to make better maps. But until very recently, most of the maps of the human cerebral cortex were based on one type of information alone, in some cases using structural MRI and information obtainable from that or from postmortem brains that were analyzed under a microscope, or using functional MRI in different studies. And they gave us maps that were improvements on the classical century-old maps, but they still left a lot to be desired, and there had not been any consensus in the field. Recently, in a paper published in the journal Nature in late last month, our colleagues in the Human Connectome Project were able to make a much improved map of human cerebral cortex that identified 180 distinct cortical areas in each hemisphere, symmetrically arranged so that the areas that we see on the left hemisphere are mirrored to a very close approximation by those we see on the right. And the reason we were able to achieve this better map was because we obtained higher quality data from each of hundreds of individual subjects. We analyzed it very carefully, and we identified the cortical areas that I've alluded to using multiple types of information, not just one type or one modality on its own.
Well, what's fascinating to me is, a lot of people look at the scanning technology as, well, you know, we'll get a bigger engine and we'll be able to get higher granularity or more detail or the better understanding of the slices and the ways of looking at it. And what you all have done in addition to that is by using an artificial intelligence series of programs, AI, self-learning AI, that is able to help identify the brain's hidden regions from looking at all of these test subjects, like so if there's a couple hundred CAT scans of a couple hundred different brains, artificial intelligence used to be able to sort of piece this together. Can you talk about that aspect of your project?
Sure, I'm happy to. This is a situation where the success in making this better map relied on a combination of intelligence provided by neuroscientists, in particular Matt Glasser, my very talented doctoral student, and myself, who are both strongly invested in understanding the neuroanatomy of the brain. So we could make a lot of progress analyzing the data and looking at it carefully with our own eyes. But you're absolutely right that we benefited tremendously from making use of an artificial intelligence approach, in essentially what we call a classifier algorithm, to take the map, the parcellation of the cerebral cortex that we originally identified on 210 distinct individuals combined together. We had mostly, through a combination of manual and semi-automated methods, had identified the 180 areas on the what we call the group average map. But then we turned this classifier algorithm, the AI approach, onto the individual brains, but using the information acquired with the group average. And we were able to identify with 96% accuracy nearly all of the 180 cortical areas in nearly all of the individuals who we analyzed. So this is really a combination of working with human intelligence and artificial intelligence to get the biggest bang for the buck.
And what fascinates me, and if I can just sort of segue for a moment, if you were building a product that was going to lift pizzas up and throw them into an oven, that lifting piece of the product that you'd be building, you'd have a little motor. And you don't have to design that motor because you can buy off-the-shelf motors from all sorts of different places. And if it meets your specifications, put it into your pizza lifting product and off it goes. And that's where we're going with artificial intelligence, to be able to buy off-the-shelf products that you can incorporate into your product that will bring the artificial intelligence capabilities into the mix. And that's just fascinating. And so you didn't I suspect you didn't actually develop the AI or the algorithms. Were you able to purchase those on the outside or get somebody to write those for you?
We took advantage of an algorithm, a classifier algorithm, that had been developed and applied to neuroscience purposes by Carl Hacker, one of our co-authors on the study. He had first had success using this in a different neuroimaging project, and Matt Glasser worked with Carl to adapt this algorithm, this automated approach, to the particular needs and constraints of our human connectome project, very rich, multiple modality data set.
If you're just joining us, our guest is David Van Essen from Van Essen Laboratories and the Human Connectome Project. And it's funny, as I was reading through this study, David, I couldn't help but go back to that one statistic that we learned in elementary school that none of us will ever forget, and that is we only use 10% of our brain. And maybe really smart people like, you know, Einstein uses about, I don't know, 13% of his brain. But hearing now that you've identified 180 cortical regions in each side of the brain, each hemisphere, what does it say for that little statistic? Are we going to, do we know something more about what we use in our brain?
Another great question. I also learned as a child that that number, 5% or 10% of the brain, is what you use at any one time. And that's one of the deepest, most profound misunderstandings and misrepresentations of how our brain works. What we've learned, in contrast, from studying the brain using MRI methods in particular, but other technologies as well, is that nearly all of your brain is active nearly all of the time. Even when you're at rest, we study all of our subjects with what we call resting state functional MRI, where they're lying quietly in the scanner, and they're not told to do anything except look at a small spot on a blank screen. And their minds are, in some respects, idling, but their brains are tremendously active. Every region of the brain is fluctuating in the fMRI signal that relates to brain activity. So even at rest, our brains are busy, and when we're doing a task, the pattern of brain activation changes very broadly over nearly all of the brain. The signals go up or they go down, but they're not just sitting there doing nothing. So this misunderstanding that arose from early in the last century was based on the fact that in animal models, one can remove a large fraction of the brain and not see any obvious difference.
Mm.
That's not because those parts of the brains were doing nothing. It's because the elegant and very powerful design of our brains and that of animal models is very robust to injury and trauma. So if you lose part of it, there's essentially redundancy that makes the rest of it do surprisingly well in many regions. That's not completely true across the board, as anyone who has a friend or a relative who's had a stroke, there can be strokes that are devastating because they knock out very specific regions that do have specialized functions. But what we've learned over recent decades is that the brain has a lot of redundancy built in, but it also has a lot of specializations, and each part of the brain, each little patch of the cerebral cortex, for example, does have a unique constellation of functions that we're starting to better understand. But it's not working in isolation. It's working as a part of a network and part of a highly distributed system that can tolerate surprising amounts of damage to many parts of the brain structure.
So, David, back in the early 1900s, there were 52 regions identified. Then it went up to 80. And with your new research, you've got this map that we've never seen before. We've got 180 different identified areas, and you call it version 1.0, and so certainly, you know, we'll be moving to even better maps in the future. What one question would you like to see answered that has not been answered yet?
I have many questions that I would love to see progress on, so it's hard to choose any one in particular, but what I would say in broad strokes is describing what the map of these areas are is one important milestone, but the great challenge of understanding the human brain is to decipher what are the computations, what is the information processing that's going on within one or another specialized area of the brain to carry out the remarkable mental and performance capabilities that make us uniquely human. To be a little more specific, one of the areas that we studied in some detail in our recent, what we call our parcellation paper, was a specific area. We actually borrowed the name Area 55B from an anatomical study done a half century ago. And we now know from our recent look at this that Area 55B is part of a language network, is one of a collection of at least a dozen, probably more, areas that are working in an integrated way to carry out our language functions, such as me speaking and you and the audience hearing and understanding what this conversation is all about. That's really amazing, and we don't understand nearly enough about what communication and language really are doing. So going back to our Area 55B, we know it's part of a language network, but it's not a cookie-cutter replication of other parts of that network. And using the information that we've gained about better maps of the brain, we hope that will help sharpen the questions that neuroscientists and neuroimagers carry out in the future to tease apart the intricate, extraordinarily complex, and still poorly understood natures of human communication. So if there's one thing, to come back to your focus question, if there's one thing that would be high on my list of things I'd like to do, it's to understand how language and communication works in the context of the living and dynamic human brain.
That's great. Very interesting. And before we let you go, I just want to return a little bit to our brain's ability to adapt, or brain plasticity, and things like stroke. I mean, now that you've identified all of these regions that perform all of these functions, you know, is part of the Human Connectome Project making headway in, you know, in helping along, for example, stroke victims who completely lose function in one area and therefore are forever altered? Is this the path that you're on?
This is one of many projects and many essentially spin-off efforts that are already underway. The what we call the Young Adult Human Connectome Project that I've been talking about is wrapping up in terms of its original efforts and accomplishments, but the National Institutes of Health and other funding agencies are supporting a growing variety of other projects, some of which are devoted to a better understanding of the brain across the entire human lifespan, from infancy through childhood through older age. What happens to the brain as it changes during maturation and aging under healthy conditions? Even more fascinating but more challenging and incredibly important to attack are the myriad brain disorders and diseases that afflict millions of people. And you've already mentioned stroke as one of the major ones, but if you broaden that to include schizophrenia and autism and a variety of other developmentally or otherwise age-specific disorders, we'd love to get a deeper understanding of what's gone wrong in the brain in these various disorders, and what can we do to better understand, to better diagnose, and to better monitor changes, improvements in brain performance through various interventional approaches. And can we, for example, in the continuing with the effects of stroke, can we learn better ways to help other parts, non-injured parts of the brain, do a better job in the rehabilitation process that is a critical aspect of coping with stroke? These are all opportunities, but they're tremendous challenges, and the maps that we've been talking about today will help us in the direction of better designed experiments and analyses, but it's an exciting and daunting effort to really push the pendulum farther in terms of a deeper understanding of the brain and health and disease.
It's really good work. Great stuff. David Van Essen from Van Essen Laboratories and the Human Connectome Project. Thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio. And it's now 10 o'clock. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Park City Bike Demos, Kearns Boulevard next to Adolph's, parkcitybikedemos.com, Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hi, I'm Matt from San Francisco Design, celebrating 25 years in Park City. San Francisco Design is happy to sponsor public affairs programming on KPCW. For 25 years, we have been providing home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. We're located on Bonanza Drive and at sanfrandesign.com. San Francisco Design, love your home.
Want to thank, again, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway.